Welcome to this latest podcast from RN. And while you're about to hear your selected program, you may like to think about downloading the latest from The Science Show. Science never stops surprising us. The Science Show is at the RN website. I'm Robin Williams. Enjoy.
Hello there, thanks for landing at Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell with you for an hour of your morning here on RN. Coming up, fly-in, fly-out jobs, those FIFO jobs, might bring in the big whopping pay packets. But what are the consequences we might not predict for our relationships, for our physical and mental health? As this workforce explodes in scale and scope, are we conducting something of a social experiment here? The independent member for New England, Tony Windsor, is joining us shortly on the show, plus other guests. He chaired the recent inquiry into the whole issue. Also coming up, those first essential years of our lives, the crucial role of the bonds and attachments we form. It seems the psychoanalytic infant has come of age. Who's that, you say? Wait and find out. Stay with us. This year's Sydney Mardi Gras, one of the biggest gay pride parades in the world, was somewhat marred by a video that emerged in the hours after the parade. You may have seen it. The footage shows a young man who'd been at the Mardi Gras and allegedly being assaulted by police officers. Bystanders captured the scene on film, despite police telling them to stop recording. And within hours of posting on YouTube, it went viral. Here's part of what was recorded.
Turn around and put your hands behind your back.
Someone tell me what his name is. What's his name? What's his name?
What's his
name? What's his name? I didn't do anything wrong.
Hey, stop filming him.
I did nothing wrong.
I know it's not against the law.
It's illegal to film a police officer.
Yeah, I know.
Listen.
I did nothing wrong.
And we will be making fair complaints about you.
Come here.
Please do, please do.
I did nothing wrong.
He grabbed him by the throat and smashed his skull on the pavement.
Take it to the police and tell him.
No, I will. I will. Just make sure you get their badge numbers, because they're all involved.
Pretty visceral, isn't it, even to hear it, let alone see it. 1.8 million people have seen that video on YouTube now. The question we want to ask this morning, does a short video tell us the full story of what happened on that night? And we're not going to talk about that particular case, but the question we want to ask is really relevant to any of the DIY footage found right across social media, and it's an important question because many of us are now in a position to bear witness anywhere and any time with our mobile phones. But are there issues you need to be aware of as potential citizen journalists? On the line from New York now is Madeleine Baer. She's the curator of the Human Rights Channel for Witness. That's a long-time video advocacy project, originally co-founded by musician Peter Gabriel 2 decades ago now. DIY docos certainly have been around for a lot longer than mobile phones, but the question is, of course, now we can go viral with them. Welcome to ABC Radio National, Madeleine.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Look, at the heart of the Witness Project is what you call video advocacy. What's the core here of Witness?
Yeah, Witness was actually founded after an incident took place in Los Angeles in the United States that raised this whole issue that we're again talking about today in Sydney, Australia, which is police brutality. And that was when a man, Rodney King, was filmed beaten viciously by the Los Angeles police. And a man in his own apartment saw what was going on and had a camcorder in his hands and decided to film that. Mm. And that video caused nationwide and really worldwide attention to this problem of police brutality. And that's when we really wanted to leverage this power of, what can the witness do to document and expose human rights abuses?
I guess it's one thing to capture these images on film. It's another question as to what actually happens with that footage then and how it's used to make changes. Tell us about how you came to be it witness? Because your own story is interesting here. It was a trip to Jamaica.
Yeah, I was going to Jamaica to work with a human rights organization there to document police abuse again. And I happened to arrive in Kingston in the immediate aftermath of a raid which took place, in which Jamaican security forces went into a poor Kingston community to capture a wanted criminal. And by the time they left, upwards of 80 civilians had been killed. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to go in with a camera and know not only how to document what had happened, but how to do so in a way that could really make change, document it in a way that could be used for criminal courts and for international tribunals, so that, justice could be, really achieved. Mm. There's really a difference between just documenting abuse or exposing a human rights issue and bringing about justice. And that's really what witness works to do, which is to train people behind the cameras to not just expose violations, but to get in front of the eyes of people who can make a difference.
Okay, so let's tease out some of the critical issues around that. For example, questions around the authenticity of footage have become very important to you at Witness, haven't they? Because this is the era of social media. News services are sourcing footage from citizen journalists all over the world. Any of us can be citizen journalists. What are you doing around authenticity and helping people really navigate that maze when they capture abuses on camera?
Yeah, that's a huge issue that you raise, because now we have just thousands of videos being taken by people who are often anonymous and who don't come from a journalistic background, don't come from a human rights background, but recognize that, there is a violation occurring before their eyes and, other people should see it. So they whip out their cell phone and put the video on YouTube. And so for news outlets to use this footage, they really need to know, is this real? Is this what it purports to be? And there are a lot of ways that Witness and other organizations are working to help news organizations grapple with this challenge. One way is our partner at the Human Rights Channel is Storyful, and that's a news organization that works to verify citizen video for news outlets, and they use a combination of Google satellite images and social media to corroborate what is going on in the video. Mm. I think one thing that reporters and news outlets need to realize is, when they see footage on YouTube, they need to ask just the same questions that they would ask any source. Who took this? Where was it taken? How can we corroborate what information is contained in it? Because we have seen instances of fraud. We've seen instances of video that is several years old that's uploaded to YouTube and the uploaders say that this just happened. And
it goes viral. It goes viral, doesn't it?
Exactly. And, of course, with new technologies, there are ways to even animate things to purport to be reality when, in fact, it's technology. I think if news outlets, if human rights organizations don't address this challenge and put out videos that allege to be true that turn out not to be, I think we're really going to do a disservice to all of the people who are recording real video out there and whose video really needs to be taken seriously.
That's a very serious point. Sorry, go on.
Well, yeah, so to address this challenge, another thing Witness is doing is we've partnered with an organization called the Guardian Project to develop a phone application where it actually embeds in your phone the metadata of the images. So this is called Informacam. And if you download the Informacam phone app, when you take an image or a video, it will embed within that media file information that the cell phone has, such as GPS information, where and when the video was taken, so that when you then submit that video to a news reporter or to a legal agency, they can trust that this video is what you say it is.
Well, on that point, Madeleine Baer, the other issue here for any of us in any context across the world capturing these this footage on our phones is personal safety. And citizen journalists can take incredible risks and put their own safety at huge risk by capturing this, footage and then it going viral. So attaching that kind of metadata to footage, it might verify it, but it also can put the camera person at risk.
Oh, yeah, you really nailed the point right there. As much as technology can help citizen reporters, there's this flip side that it can endanger us even more. And, you know, one thing we saw when we were watching videos coming out of Iran during the Green Revolution was that the Iranian regime actually took videos of protests and put stills of those videos on their websites and asked the public to help identify faces of the protesters. And that really sent a chilling effect throughout the whole video advocacy community. We've seen the same thing in Syria. So people both behind the camera and on the video themselves are at risk when we're talking about human rights and especially repressive regimes. And so, you know, we've actually at Witness developed something that's really the inverse of the Informa Cam, which is called the Obscura Cam.
Oh, yes. What's so that? I mean, you're doing incredible work with footage coming out of Syria and as you say, that partnership with Storyful. You're working very hard to verify some of the horrible footage that's coming out of Syria. But what's Obscura Cam?
Obscura Cam is a way that that activists in repressive regimes or when they might be the only one talking about an abuse and they're at risk of authorities or of the perpetrators if they put their face on film and talk about that abuse, they can actually protect their anonymity. So Obscura Cam will blur faces taken in video. So it's really using this new technology of facial recognition to protect the anonymity of people at risk. And we've also lobbied YouTube to actually implement the same sort of thing within the YouTube platform itself. So now anyone who uploads a video onto YouTube can choose after they upload it to anonymize the faces and blur the faces. And so, you know, this is just a part of educating the public surrounding the use of video as this is becoming more and more common to document not only birthday parties and cats, but, you know, human rights abuses.
Yes, absolutely. Just finally, an important question, because even if you manage to verify a piece of footage that's been taken and distributed on YouTube or published on the Witness website, the human rights channel that you curate, it may not be useful or satisfy the requirements of an international criminal court inquiry into human rights abuses. And so then it's not even effective video advocacy, really, is it?
Yeah, you know, video is one part of the path to bringing about justice. There are many different layers and many different factors that go into, you know, really achieving that justice. So the fact that, for instance, this video at the city Mardi Gras was taken, we can see that it's really instigated a nationwide dialogue surrounding police abuse in Australia. But we've yet to see really what the impact of that video will be in court. And so we really need to talk about ways to use video actually as evidence in legal trials. And this is such a new arena that courts and legal agencies and even the International Criminal Court are really grappling with dealing with this. How can we both trust the authenticity of a video, filter videos if we're talking about a case like Syria where there are just thousands of videos coming out, and use them to actually bring about justice?
Yes, look, it's a very interesting field and I think it'll give pause for thought for people who's hit record on their mobile phones next time, and we'll link to the Witness website. Madeleine Baer, thank you very much for joining us on the program this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Madeleine Baer there, she is video curator for human rights, for the human rights video advocacy website and channel Witness, witness.org. joining us there from New York. We will put all the information on the Life Matters website. Very interesting, don't you think? Natasha Mitchell with you on Life Matters this morning. FIFO and Dido. No, not the musician. You'll hear.
I didn't notice that the front door had these bullet holes in it. In fact, I thought it was some sort of creative, you know, fly screen.
Now hear this. Now available as a podcast.
I have always, as long as I can remember, I've always envied other people's hair. And I've envied people who have floppy hair.
Now hear this. Listen online anytime at the RN website. And you too can be part of Now Hear This. Find all the details of the next storytelling slam at the RN website.
How long is your commute home from work? Think about that for a moment. Well, think about that moment, I should say, you open your front door when you get back to the hearth. Does it replenish you, revive you, reconnect you with the other things that are important in your life? For many workers in rural and remote areas now, it's a very long drive home indeed, or a long flight. Fly in, fly out. FIFO, or drive-in, drive-out Dido workers, were the subject of a recent parliamentary inquiry chaired by Tony Windsor, you might recall. Local communities are feeling the pressure of this transient workforce, we know that. But are we any closer to having a more complete picture of the personal and psychological cost on the workers themselves of those generous pay packets that they've signed up for? The inquiry, it seems, concluded no. More research needs to be done on that front. In a moment, two people in WA really now trying to get a handle on that question. But joining us first on the line is Tony Windsor, the independent member of New England. Thanks for joining us, Tony.
Pleasure, Natasha.
Look, you heard, Tony, from a variety of health agencies in this inquiry. Were there some really strong conclusions about the health challenges that stood out for you at the end of it?
Well, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence as to the social and economic and personal impacts of not only the fly-in, fly-out arrangements where people are away from their homes for quite long periods of time, but the changes in rosters and the hours that workers are being asked to do. And if you're a fly-in, fly-out person going to work 1,000 k's from where you live, and quite a lot of them said, look, if I'm away from home, I want to do as many hours as I can and then get back home. So the sense of community in the place they're going to is almost nil in a lot of cases. So, but that is having an impact on people. You know, obviously, you can't generalise because, well, there is no evidence to really make, you know, great generalisations, but different people can handle the stresses and strains differently to others as well.
What impact did the different rostering regimes have? What did people say about the personal impact of those?
Well, it's a two-way impact, in a sense, an impact on the fly-in, fly-out person, because at the end of their, you know, maybe their 10 or 14-day shift or whatever it happens to be, there's a whole variation of those. But a 12-hour shift each day is effectively 14 or 15 by the time you prepare to go to work and get home from work, etc. So at the end of those periods of times, you know, some of the families were saying that when Dad comes home, for the first two or three days he's not here at all. You can see him, but he's not here. And then he has a few days when he is there, and then they see him go back into preparing to go back to these massive hours and long rosters. So that has an impact on all people. The other thing, though, that I think is being missed by some people in terms of this debate is that the workers who happen to be residential workers in communities, and Kalgoorlie was a classic example of this, a lot of people there, very proud mining town, still residing in Kalgoorlie, want to reside in Kalgoorlie, and the impact of the fly-in, fly-out roster and long hours is having another impact on those who want to reside there but are being pressurised into carrying out the same sort of rosters as the fly-in people. Now, that has another impact on sense of community, community values, another impact on Dad being able to help with, you know, coaching the kids' soccer, etc. So there's very much a two-way stream.
Yes, indeed. There were other health issues that emerged in the inquiry, weren't there? And that was around kind of risk behaviours and alcohol and substance abuse or misuse or use.
Yeah, so they all came through. Some people, you know, after a period of time were being depressed, whether they were the worker or the wife or the partner. alcohol, drugs, the whole gambit, living in camps, tended to get on some people's goat after, doing it for an extended period of time. All of those things, we really don't have any real data. And there's a number of people, and I'm pleased that one of your people today is going to be talking about that. We need that information, and one of the recommendations was on a number of levels, we've got to find out what this work practice actually means, not only in terms of the sense of community that on some of the communities it's impacting on, but what does it mean long-term for the children of these relationships, for the wives and parents and husbands and partners, etc. What sort of pressures is it pushing back onto the communities they come from? Because half the time, half the family is away somewhere else. So there's very much those impacts at where the person comes from, is also where the person goes to.
Yes, indeed. It's interesting that we don't have a clear handle on that, isn't it? Because it's effectively a large-scale social experiment that we're doing with the Australian workforce, with the FIFO and DIDO workers.
Well, it is. And we got the feeling, and I'm pretty sure that this is the case, that a lot of the mining companies have much more information than they've released.
What sort of information?
Well, in terms of the way in which their workers suffer stress over time and how that plays itself out, a lot of those people are just seen as, if I'm being a bit crude here, I guess, but as receptacles for use for the mining company. And if they can't hack the pace, well, we're going to get another one off the shelf and fly that particular individual in and test the market there. So we seem to get the inference from a lot of people, including medicos, GPs, etc., that are working at both ends of the spectrum, that there are some very real issues out there that the companies probably have a greater feel for than they're letting on, because of the obvious negative impacts that could apply to the work practice. This is a work practice that has come out of remote Western Australia, in a sense. Now it's being imposed in very settled areas, and where I live, Tamworth's a 50, 60,000 population. There's towns of 8, 10, 15, 20,000 in the vicinity. But the fly-in, fly-out mentality is starting to arrive here.
It's extending across a variety of industries, mining, construction, health, to name a few, I guess. What you're implying there, Tony, is that there's a culture or an attitude that workers are expendable and that perhaps the high pay levels will do more than compensate for the negative aspects of this work. But certainly employers would argue that they have employer support programs in place. Did the inquiry reveal whether they are effective or being utilised by workers?
Well, some companies are doing that, and this is the great problem with generalising. Here, there's no doubt that some companies have a different approach to others, and I don't want to get into naming that. And there is a different approach. The committee spent some time in Mongolia, where the same companies are operating, and in Canada, where the fly-in, fly-out phenomenon's been going for longer than it has here.
Yeah, right.
And the same companies are addressing different community-based strategies in the three countries that the report covers. I think in some cases, some of the companies are taking advantage of the moment, and there's been this sort of gold rush mentality. But to start establishing work camps in areas where there are quite large populations and TAFEs and all the universities, etc., seems to suggest to me that there is this yen for a total control of the workforce, that you can actually switch it on and switch it off if, in fact, the resource price varies or company circumstances vary. If you have ownership of a community, which some companies do, you're more likely than not to maintain a relationship with the locals, employ locals. The social impacts of this work practice could actually hollow out regional communities, and that's what the Kalgoorlie mayor is saying, to the extent that it changes the whole fabric of regional life. If you can do it with a mine worker, why can't you do it with the doctor, the dentist, the candlestick maker, the grader driver? Why do you have regional communities if in fact you can fly them in and out from somewhere? If it's totally about choice, most of our people might choose, as they have in Western Australia, nearly 80% of them live in Perth, most of them might choose to live there and fly in to get the money. But what does that do to all the other communities that they're impacting on? And there's no work being done on that. We go to that exact issue, and the report does, that this is all about choice. Should it be all about choice, or should it be about the social structures that we end up with as a nation?
Yes.
The transportation of the work practice into very settled and established economies is of great concern, and should be of great concern to anybody who's interested about country Australia.
Much bigger than health, as you have demonstrated, and we will watch with interest. Tony Windsor, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Okay, thanks very much, Natasha.
Tony Windsor there, independent member for New England. So the inquiry he headed up recommended that more information be gathered, more data talks, more information gathered about just what is happening in terms of the health and well-being of people doing fly-in, fly-out type jobs. Well, Lifeline WA is making a start there. They've just launched a survey online they want workers to fill out. Fiona Califf is the CEO of Lifeline WA. Hello, Fiona.
Natasha, thank you very much for having me.
Yes, we also have Libby Brooke joining us. She's a psychologist with the School of Psychology at Murdoch University, and she's been researching this whole issue of the impacts of this work lifestyle on, well, the well-being of workers. Welcome, Libby.
Good morning.
Great to have you both. Now, Fiona, as CEO of Lifeline WA, you are literally just this week launching a survey around this whole workforce. Tell us about what that survey is and what prompted it.
Look, we were hearing anecdotally some really great positives about the FIFO Dido lifestyle, but also some quite severe negatives. And hearing from Tony Windsor and going through his report as well, you can see and read that for almost every pro, there's a perception of a con as well. So we felt that we needed to understand better the relationship between mental health and the fly-in, fly-out and drive-in, drive-out lifestyle in the mining, construction and other occupations that are related to this sector. We have a partnership with a vehicle hire company in the Pilbara called Raw Hire, and in talking to those guys, they were keen also to understand what those impacts could be. So really the first step of the project is to inform FIFO and Dido workers about this survey. We're really keen to create the largest possible sample size because other research, and Libby can certainly correct me if we're wrong on this, but other research so far has been relatively smallish sample sizes in the numbers of hundreds, in the low hundreds. We're keen to get a really broad cross-section of respondents.
Yes.
In the sector. And Tony Windsor, I think, put it really well when he said different people handle the different stresses and strains differently. So for some people, they handle and cope with these stresses and strains in really positive ways. And others perhaps are coping or trying to cope, but in less positive ways.
When and that's tricky, isn't it? Because then it's actually hard sometimes to extract out the impact of the fly-in, fly-out lifestyle on a person's mental health, because they might have a whole lot of other circumstances or a temperament that means that there are vulnerabilities there anyway.
That's right. And we don't know whether there's cause and effect or whether it's coincidence. What we do know is in the community, mental illness is not uncommon. So if you overlay that into FIFO and Dido lifestyle, then of course you're going to find that a number of people at any given point in time are coping with anxiety, depression and other forms of mental illness. But what we're really trying to discover with this survey is the ways in which people cope. And from there, we're keen to develop vital supports to help others in the FIFO Dido lifestyle.
Well, every good survey, though, is kind of built on a set of anecdotal questions or experiences used to sort of inform what you want to get at. So what kind of domains of people's life are you questioning about?
We're asking some fairly straightforward questions around, you know, we're asking people to tell us about the types of rosters they work, whether they're, and then the types of rosters from there, the types of shifts that they're working, whether it's regular, fixed rosters, irregular, or flexible rosters. And we're also then asking people to tell us about the type of challenges they face and the ways in which they cope with these challenges. Now, for some people, that their coping mechanisms, as I said earlier, will be positive coping mechanisms. So it might be that they make particular effort to eat more healthily or get some exercise at the gym there. But for others, their coping mechanisms might be less than what we would normally think as being healthy. So they might be eating more than usual, or they might be using alcohol more than usual. So again, we're trying to understand the types of coping mechanisms that people are using, and also trying to get an indication from people, self-assessed, as to how they feel their emotional state is as well.
Very important getting some numbers on this. So that survey is live now. Can I bring in Libby Brook from Murdoch University? Let's really connect with your research, because you have been looking at some of these questions, and your approach was to survey workers and their partners separately.
Correct.
What was the motivation there, Libby?
One of my co-researchers, she was a FIFO partner and I am a FIFO partner. So we have a particular interest in looking at how partners cope and whether or not they have kids and how they feel about the different roster lengths. So it's good that Fiona's bringing that up, because it's actually, particularly with over 21 days on the roster length, the partners really were dissatisfied with the rosters, but the workers themselves weren't necessarily. And we think that that's probably because they had a longer leave period, you see. So it's probably the actual workers themselves were looking forward to having a long leave. And as Tony Windsor said, you know, while they're there, they may as well get as much work done as possible. But I think while they're there, the partners were really feeling dissatisfied with the fact that their partner wasn't there to help.
So there was a real tension there, wasn't there? Because, okay, so as you say, the workers wanted kind of longer rosters, so they got longer time off, and it was probably made for a more coherent life experience for them. But back at home, they wanted quicker turnaround rostering, didn't they?
Yes, yeah. And it's interesting, because there have been different results found on this roster lengthening across many studies across, you know, the last 30 years or so. It's not necessarily a new thing. So we're looking at, you know, differences between 1 week on, 1 week off, to 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and we found that there was only a difference with the partners when it got to over 21 days. I think it does depend on the different sites and a whole lot of other factors as well.
In what way?
Well, our study is also ongoing, so we're trying to look at a whole lot of variables about whether or not people are happy in their actual job itself, so how they feel supported by their organisation, by their supervisor, what kind of supports they draw on. So we found that the workers themselves tend to draw on their co-workers a lot if they find that it's a supportive environment. We've heard anecdotally that some workplaces are not necessarily supportive and can undermine, for example, relationships and, you know, this toughen up princess culture that's supposedly at some work sites. I won't say all, because I don't think it's at all of them. I think it's at some work sites. And I think that that would tap into Fiona's work as well, looking at, you know, whether or not it's actually socially acceptable to actually seek the help in the first place.
Ah, now that's key, isn't it? And really the interesting thing here is that, as in trying to get at the impressions of workers and the impressions they have of whether companies actually care for them and care for their well-being as workers, the indication is that many workers don't have that sense.
Yeah, well, we found sort of at a midpoint, which means that there is more that can be done. There were 69% of employees were aware of the fact that they could access their employee assistance programs, but the actual partners, there were less than 40% knew that that possibly extended to them.
Fiona Califf, let me come back to you, CEO of Lifeline Western Australia. This idea of kind of encouraging people to seek support when they need it, it's complex in this community of workers, isn't it? Because often they don't have access, easy access to these services with this kind of itinerant lifestyle.
Absolutely, absolutely. But certainly what we can say with a level of confidence without even having started our research is that people working on the FIFO and DIDO rosters have less accessibility to broader services. So certainly there will be EAPs or employee assistance programs in place, but you know, in many instances employees don't access those programs, whether they be homebound or working a FIFO or DIDO roster. But what, as I say, we do know is that it's going to be difficult for a FIFO or DIDO worker to have a regular session with a counsellor, for instance, when they're working those sorts of rosters. And it may be difficult for them to book in and see their GP, or they might feel that once they're home, they don't have feelings of anxiety or depression and everything will be all right. And then before they know it, they're back on the job again. So as I said, one of the key things that we're looking at as the outcome of this research is trying to discover the ways that people cope and try to extrapolate that into developing support services. You know, one of those might be, and it's alluded to in Tony Windsor's report as well, you know, web-based counselling services and increasing the web-based services, not just that, say, an organisation like Lifeline offers, but working with employer groups to put in place some of these support mechanisms.
Is that something that you see yourself, Lifeline, extending into, a more kind of online environment to support workers rather than a telephone helpline?
Look, I mean, Lifeline obviously already has its telephone crisis support line, and recently we've launched online crisis support. We have a range of counselling services as well, and very keen to explore greater levels of accessibility for these counselling services, particularly the crisis counselling services, when somebody might be at a point of emotional crisis. And so it's from this research that we're hoping to be able to develop those mechanisms. We already work fairly closely with a number of employer groups in terms of crisis support for their workplace, but this is a whole other area that we need to understand more before we come up with a solution to a problem that we don't quite understand yet.
The problem that we don't quite understand. Libby Brooke, finally to you, where are you going to take this work?
Well, we're expanding into looking very similar to Fiona at coping mechanisms and alcohol use on site, and also anxiety and depression as well this year, but as well as their roster. I think that that's really interesting for us, continuing to look at whether or not the organisation itself is having an impact on these things. And as Fiona indicated, it really is difficult to get great big numbers of participants. So a lot of the research that's been done has been on small numbers, and they've been quite localised to a particular area or a particular organisation. So both of these studies are well worth their time, trying to get as many people to respond as possible, because the more we understand about it, the more that the organisations and the people themselves can, I guess, be prepared for the outcome.
Yes, indeed. Good luck with both of your work. Sounds like you should collaborate, folks. Libby Brooke, thank you, from Murdoch University, and Fiona Kayla, for a CEO of Lifeline Western Australia. Thank you.
Thanks, Natasha.
And we'll put the links to the Lifeline WA survey and Libby's survey too, which is still active, on the Life Matters website, abc.net.au/radionational/Life Matters. Spread the word. Help them out with collecting data. This is an important one. It might be a case of swings and roundabouts for you. You might benefit from what they learn at the end of it all if you're a FIFO or DIDO worker. In a moment, we're heading back to babyhood. Did you know that the word infant comes from the Latin infans, which apparently means speechless and inarticulate, newborn, childish, foolish? What a good time many of us had being childish and foolish and inarticulate while we could. That's a child prerogative, after all. We can be all of those things, but we need secure attachments with a caring adult in those early years too. Without that, many people certainly go on to achieve a great deal in their adult lives, but psychologists like my next guest see things come unstuck for adults who have experienced fractured attachments as a child. She's written an ambitious and curious book, Bringing Up Baby, The Psychoanalytic Infant Comes of Age. And you might be surprised to hear she's not just a professor of psychology, she's also a leading professor of music. Diana Kenny is based at the University of Sydney, a long-time advocate for the rights of children, a child and adolescent psychologist, and she's even established a foundation in Nepal for children living in poverty. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you.
Do you sleep?
Oh, yes.
Why, as a professor of music, You find yourself writing a book with a title like The Psychoanalytic Infant Comes of Age?
Well, I have two distinct chairs at the University of Sydney, and my last book was called The Psychology of Music Performance Anxiety. So this book comes from my psychological hat, it was, you know, they take it turnabout. So.
But in fact, it does stem from those two key areas of interest for you. Intense research and work over the years on performance anxiety in gifted young musicians, but also work with young offenders. And there is a connection here in a sense, isn't there? Because that kind of past environment that we occupy as small children has an impact on anxiety, has an impact on delinquent behaviour when we grow up.
Very much so, yes. Whether you're a gifted musician or a young offender, something has gone wrong in your early life to create the extreme forms of anxiety that some performers feel, and also to create the extreme sense of alienation and dislocation from mainstream society that young offenders feel, and to which they resort to criminal behaviour to meet some of those psychosocial needs that they have to belong and to feel like a valued person.
You know, people get rather nervous, Diana, about old psychoanalytic theories like those of Sigmund Freud, his daughter Anna Freud, Melanie Klein, any number of people being kind of dredged out to inform contemporary parenting, don't they? Who is the psychoanalytic infant you're exploring in this book?
Primarily, the book starts with Freud's infant and his theory of infant sexuality. But I think Freud and Klein and the early psychoanalysts have probably...
I'm glad you can't say that word either. I've been trying to say it for years on air and I still stumble. But go on.
They've been misinterpreted and misquoted for more than 120 years. And part of this book was to show the very strong links and insights, the profound insights that these early people had on human behaviour, human development. A lot of their work has been taken out of context and misquoted. And I think that's why there's a lot of confusion about the nature of their contribution to human thinking.
And they were contributions of their time, and there's been a lot of work on infant development since. I mean, parents, let's just come to this point. Parents project all sorts of expectations on their children. Some are obviously less healthy than others. And there's a plea at the heart of this book, isn't there, that centres around those expectations that parents have. What is that plea?
Basically, in a very competitive, highly developed society in which we live, everything is difficult to come by, you know, places at university. And if we look at places like China and Singapore, children are competing for the best preschools. There are some very disturbing programs coming out of the Asian culture about hothousing children and turning them into little mini geniuses by the time they're 3 and 4. And this is a very disturbing trend that we see even in Australia, where the majority of Asian children and now a large proportion of Australian children are being coached in out-of-school hours, coaching colleges.
It never stops.
It never stops. And the expectation and the competition can be extremely damaging and overwhelming to children.
So what's your plea?
Well, the plea...
Stop it now? I mean, you're working with gifted young musicians, so you know this better than most.
Yes. It has to do with allowing the child's genes and environment to interact in a way that allows for a natural developmental unfolding of each individual's particular personality and talents. And sometimes parents get overly anxious about young gifted children and also children with difficulties. But if we go back to the gifted child, that they see this talent and they feel that it's their responsibility to encourage it, enhance it. But also there are some unconscious processes happening there whereby...
For the parent,
where the parent sometimes has this unconscious need to fulfil their own aspirations through their children. Many parents will say the right things, that it's whatever they want, what makes them happy. But underneath that veneer, there's an anxiety, there's hopes that may not be the child's hopes.
Well, you're more blunt about that. I mean, you say that parents can be narcissistic in their expectations of their children. And narcissistic can be a harsh word, but it implies, you know, that parents have lost the plot a bit, actually, that they're more self-involved than we might imagine in their parenting.
Oh, look, I think that's a little bit harsh. And the word narcissistic is one of the words that's come into lay lexicon, but it's misused because... Freud used the word, but he didn't use it in the pejorative way that we use it today. And every single person needs some healthy narcissistic grandiosity. Otherwise, we just couldn't survive in this very difficult world, you know, that we have. So all of us have that. But for some people, it takes over the personality that, and we talk about people who are entitled, you know, and who have this sense of being far more intelligent and important than everybody else. But hopefully most of us don't develop that narcissistic part of ourselves to a pathological level.
Diana Kenny is my guest this morning on Life Matters. She's Professor of Psychology and Professor of Music at the University of Sydney. She's written a book, Bringing Up Baby, The Psychoanalytic Infant Comes of Age. Let's explore some of the ideas that I guess emerged from the history of psychoanalysis but have a contemporary relevance now, because there's an interesting convergence going on with some of those early ideas and neurobiology. But one of them is this idea of us as self-actualized, autonomous adults, and that is a healthy way to be, and that's what I guess parents should be aiming for with their children. What can go wrong, though? What when in those early first few years? I mean, we've alluded to it now, but well, let's put it this way: what needs to happen in those first few years?
Well, Freud said that the tie between the mother and the infant is the foundation for all future relationships. And that was his great contribution to psychology and to child development, that if the relationship to the early primary caregivers, and we know now that both mothers and fathers and other significant others are very important to early development, but let's just use the word mother to represent those early caregivers. If
I don't know that the fathers listening will appreciate that, but I get the point.
Well, in the early days and weeks, there's what we call a maternal preoccupation, and these are very critical periods of time for the development of the infant. And in that period, the mother needs to be attuned empathically to the infant's needs because, of course, the infant can't communicate via words. And so the mother becomes very focused on interpreting the signals that the baby gives out. And as the child develops, this rapport between the mother and child hopefully develops and then becomes converted into language. So emotion that can be brought into language and responded to appropriately by early caregivers provides the foundation of security for the child.
And attachment.
And attachment, security and attachment. Mm. So what needs to happen in a nutshell is that there needs to be physical and emotional proximity of the primary caregiver and the infant, whereby the mother becomes what we call the secure base for the child to go out and explore the world.
And that next step is crucial too, isn't it? And that doesn't always happen.
The next step?
That next step of a child, once they form those close attachments, then being able to develop a sort of sense of their autonomous self.
That's right. It comes out of this attachment to the mother. And so if you've ever seen a mother and toddlers in a park, the mother will sit on the bench and the toddler will start to explore, but will constantly turn back to check that mother is still there. Mm-hmm. And if they venture too far and become anxious, they run back to mother. And so the other function of the mother is to provide a safe haven when the exploration in the world becomes too anxiety provoking or the child feels that he's wandered too far from mother.
Mm.
So the mother is the secure base, but she's also the safe haven for the child to return to after their explorations in developing their own autonomy.
Mm. Those attachments are crucial, and we know that. And we know that partly now because of the neurobiological story that's emerging. So there's been, as I pointed out, that kind of interesting convergence. What's convergence between some of those early psychoanalytic thoughts and recent biological research? What's most convincing for you?
Well, I think the work of the ethologists was extremely important in developing our understanding of the biological underpinnings of human relationships. And just very briefly, an ethologist called Konrad Lorenz discovered that newborn goslings, that's baby geese,
it was wonderful work,
would follow the first moving object that they saw, and if it wasn't the mother goose, they would follow something else, and in this case it was the researcher. And so using that work, John Bowlby was one of the key attachment theorists, and he and Lorenz together formed the understanding that attachment, emotional attachment, is a biologically driven process in human beings. And this is what occurs in the very early hours and weeks after birth through a hormone called oxytocin that encourages
that great bonding
the
hormone.
Mother to bond and to be very preoccupied with her infant to ensure its survival in those few early days and weeks where the infant is totally helpless and dependent.
And, of course, that's been verified. They didn't know about oxytocin then necessarily, of course.
That's right.
But now we do know about that, and there's dopamine and there's a whole sort of swill of hormones, including cortisol, the stress hormone. What can go terribly wrong in terms of those attachments? I mean, obviously abuse, that's a very clear fracturing of that first attachment.
Yes. There are some what we call large T traumas that can occur in the early lifespan that damage a person for the rest of their lives. And as you've just alluded to, physical and emotional abuse and neglect in a chronic form and sexual abuse, which is a complete betrayal of trust between the adult caregiver and the child. Other things like the death of a parent and an ugly divorce can impact. But what we're understanding now is that it's not so much events, discrete events in a child's life that can cause such terrible damage, but the chronic misattunement of a mother to an infant's signals, so that the child doesn't have...
Is that placing too much blame on mother? We have to be very careful about that legacy.
Look, it's not about blame, because mothers who are chronically misattuned to their infants have been chronically misattuned to by their own mothers. It's a generational transmission of psychopathology.
And you were just describing what that misattunement looks like.
Yes, it's where the mother can't respond with joy to the joyful utterances of her child, who can't respond with care and sympathy for the child's distress.
Certainly mothers will have times where they're nursing a young infant and they feel very much like they can't respond to the joyful babble of their child. There's going to be sort of phases of that.
Absolutely.
It's about a kind of continuum, isn't it?
Well, Donald Winnicott, a very famous child psychoanalyst, talked about the good enough mother, that obviously there is no such thing as the ideal or perfect mother, but there is a point at which a mother may not be good enough to ensure the psychological survival of her infant. And that's what we're really talking about. It's not that the mother has to be tuned 100% of the time every single day of that infant's life. And the infant does have other attachments that can be compensatory.
And that's important to realise too. It's not a hopeless cause for many children. If there is someone else that can come in and they can form a close attachment to early on in their lives, it can compensate.
That's absolutely right. And one of the very important pieces of research by the ethologists who used animal models was one by Robert Hind, who found that separation from the mother and dislocation from familiar surroundings is almost unrecoverable. You know, that the animals would slip into profound despair, that it was very difficult to bring these young animals out of. And I think that's a very important model for us to think about in terms of the refugee crisis that the world is facing. That young children who have lost their relatives, who've watched them being murdered in front of their eyes, and then they're removed from their familiar surroundings into a so-called better place. These are traumas from which some young people are unable to recover.
And this is a salient point to make at a time where we have children in detention in Australia,
exactly.
A very live discussion. So much more we could talk about. I'm really grateful that you gave us a taste of some of these ideas that you've been exploring in your work. Diana Kenny, thank you very much for joining us on Life Matters.
You're most welcome, and thank you for inviting me.
Diana is Professor of Psychology and Professor of Music at the University of Sydney. Bringing Up Baby, the Psychoanalytic Infant Comes of Age, is her book out through Karnak Books, and we'll pop the details on the Life Matters website. Don't forget our listener feedback line, 02833 1430, 02833 1430. Next on the show, our Friday talkback, of course, we'll be giving you the dirt on getting clean as flu season approaches. We'll look at a really intriguing history of hand washing and hygiene. There's an interesting evolutionary story there too, but are we obsessed with hygiene these days? Could we do with a bit more dirt instead of all those kind of sprays and wipes that we're using? We'll look forward to your calls after the news. Bye for now.
On the Health Report, a new Australian-developed treatment for long-term back pain. It's cheap and doesn't involve drugs, needles or scalpels. Plus guns and gun control. A US expert describes what the Americans could be doing to control guns, given that theirs will always be a gun culture. That's with me, Norman Swan, and if you want to hear more, why not download a Health Report podcast from RN's website?